Welcome to the Honesty Talks podcast. I am so glad you are joining the conversation today. I hope that you will dig deep with us, think honestly, and allow God to challenge us. As we explore, it is my hope that we grow and see more together.
Hello, everyone. Super excited for you to join us today for our Shabbat part two, or Sabbath part two. Last week we talked, Noah and I talked a whole bunch about starting to talk about what actual Sabbath is. And we are going to continue that conversation because we kind of ended on a really good question of like what actually happens in Shabbat. And so we're going to kind of talk about that today and wherever else God leads us in scripture. So as related to this subject, Noah is with us here today.
Good to be with you, Trin.
We are going to dive right in, and I'm just going to hand the reins over to Noah.
So, Trin, could you repeat that question one more time?
What actually happens in Sabbath?
Okay, so what happens in Sabbath, what happens in Shabbat, what happens in the stopping is I want to suggest we enter into God time, which is eternity in the present tense.
Oh, please repeat that.
Yes. We enter into God time, which is eternity in the present tense.
When we talk about Shabbat, it's also leaving it feels like you're leaving a constraint of like normal time. Because when you enter eternity, I just feel like God's timing just doesn't line up with our very linear timing. Have you ever had those moments, Noah, where you touch eternity and eternity happens, what seems to be a short period of time? And it's hard to explain, but it's like you dip into something so deep and transformative that it doesn't feel like regular time. It's almost like time ceases or doesn't move the same. And I don't even know if you have other better descriptive words, but I'm having a hard time describing, but I know what it feels like.
You know, and I love, as you said, it almost feels like on one level, like it ceases and simultaneously, like I'm experiencing more of it.
It's like, how does time cease? And then also how do you feel like so much is happening in that time? It's not with like the normal rushed kind of numb pattern. It's both. And I just feel like anything that's like that is just totally biblical. Cause I just feel like God is super paradoxical. I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to go all the way to the other end and I'm going to do this. And then you're going to have to stand in the middle and hold the tension. Ta-da.
Yeah. Well, and I love, as you said in that thing, the transformative nature of this time. It is so wildly transformative. And I think what gets to be so hard is it's not formulaic in what that experience might be of the time. Right. And so I could be experiencing God's time, which is eternity, in the present tense, any multitude of ways. And I think what makes it so hard, I think sometimes for people to inhabit that is, well, it's going to look like this, or I'm going to feel like this afterwards, or there'll be these outcomes and those deliverables from this stopping, Shabbatting I'm doing. Not really. When one enters into eternity in the present tense, it's assuredly in the present tense. And that can be so many different. That can be so, yeah.
I feel like, too, it spills over into the rest of your life. Even when you have those moments where you dip into what feels like eternity, you spend so much time even unpacking after the fact what just happened. I felt like I was trying, like when I was in Israel with your dad a couple of years ago, so much, it was like it was a thin place. I felt like I was touching eternity several times there. And it took me years. And I think I'm still unpacking what actually happened there because some of it, there are just no words for. It was crazy. And like, there was this one time we walked in the Valley of Elah and I felt like I was the kind of Sabbath time with my cohort I was in was meeting right there and with mm-hmm. your dad. And we were studying like the David and Goliath story that had had such impact on my life. And I was literally thinking in my head, I wish I would have gotten anointed here. And he looked at me and he goes, "Hey, two olive trees, natural anointing." And I was like, "You're in my head." But it was just this like beautiful time. And then like after that, we talked about you and our relationship. And he was like, said some really wonderful, beautiful things about that. This just doesn't feel like normal. Like God was there. People I love were there. We were meeting God like crazy. And I feel like I was still finding words for a lot of experiences.
Okay, well, Trent, and as you talked about the land, it's just too perfect of a tie-in. So this is Numbers chapter 27, verse 12. Numbers 27, verse 12. Now in Numbers 27, verse 12, just as a quick reminder, the children of Israel have not gone into the promised land yet. We're roughly in year 40. We are in year 40, but we have not gone into the promised land yet. This is Numbers 27, verse 12. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Ascend these heights of Abarim and view the land that I have given to the Israelite people.'" Now, there's so much going on, but just one word to pick out here. When it says that I have given, in Hebrew, it's the word natati. Natati, which is I give, but it's I give in the completed action tense of the verb to give. So it's saying give, but in the sense of it's already been given, a completed action. Hebrew, it gets to the whole verb tense structure of the language. And in Hebrew, just to kind of, it's a much larger conversation, but basically all verbs exist in action that is complete, action that is not yet complete. And in Numbers 27, verse 12, the Lord says to Moses, "The land that I gave you to the Israelite people. Look at the land that I gave to the Israelite people." Now, we haven't gone into the land yet, but here's the Lord saying, I already gave it to you.
It's already complete.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes we're thinking, well, but like, we didn't go in yet. So does that really count? Because, I mean, we haven't gone in yet. So how could he give it to us if we're not there? And God's saying, oh, I already gave it to y'all. And so I just think, you know, when you talk about what it means to unpack eternity in the present tense and experience God's time, eternity in the present tense, I loved, as you said, the time it takes to actually unpack that. That, you know, here we are, years later, you're still unpacking things. And it was just too fitting of being in the land. You know, you're being in the land of Israel. And here the Lord literally saying, oh yeah, I already gave it to you. And we're thinking, well, in order for God to give it to us, I think so many times moderns, I think, you know, in order for something to have been given, I have to have received it, or it has to, there has to, these events have to have happened. And God's making it very clear. Sometimes there's things that have happened, and before they've ever even happened, it's already happened. You know, and we're thinking the event has to transpire in what we would call real time in order for it to be completed action. Except for God is actually throwing out a very, I think, challenging idea, which is, well, as far as God's concerned, it's already completed. I gave it to you.
So then the challenge is to just actually step into it.
Yeah.
Like, inhabit it. I was just having this conversation yesterday with one of my friends, because we've been talking as like the church that I'm a pastor of, we've been talking about in this season preparing for First Fruits, Shavuot, and Pentecost, that we're walking toward our true selves. And it went into this beautiful conversation of really, we're just learning how to inhabit who we really are. God's already done and created this beautiful person and everyone. We have to learn how to uninhabit the things that aren't truly us and inhabit what is really who we are. And I feel like this is like a joint conversation. We just need to inhabit what God has already given. So it's like, I feel like we like go from this, I have to work for it, I have to earn it, which goes like, I feel like goes like completely against like what God teaches.
The whole idea of Shabbat.
Yeah. Yeah. And we say we don't believe that. Like, no, God freely gives it. But we act as if we actually have to justify it being given to us and we have to work for it. or all of this other stuff. And isn't that the whole conversation we're having about when they actually go into the promised land, the problem is they don't know how to inhabit it.
Yep. That is such a great conversation having with your friend, right? And in that vein, I think we see it so often actually with kids. Oh, this is who God's created them to be. And we see those glimpses. And it's not as if it's not there. It's not as if it's not real. And they're actually, I think we see it with kids from such a young age, actually at times really being, living who God's created them to be. And then, as you said, there's all these other experiences, life events, words, difficulties that you're almost trying to climb, well, but is that actually who God's created me to be? And we can see it in a person. And it's absolutely something that sometimes doesn't manifest, maybe one might say, in the fullest sense until someone's maybe in their, you know, if they get it really early in their late 20s, but maybe 30s, 40s, 50s, right? Or for some people, maybe if they're incredibly exceptional in their teens or 20s. But we can see glimpses of that, and it's no less real when they're 4 years old exhibiting that behavior, living that out, than it is in their 40s. But, you know, we're looking at it, and it was just eternity in the present tense. There they are, eternity in the present tense. That is such a great conversation you're having with your friend.
Well, so, and I took a risk this year, because it's easy to put out, like, devotionals that are, like, fluffy and, like, who wants to read a devotional? How do you watch your true self and, like, face the reality of where we're not actually inhabiting who God created us to be? And it's not that it's not there. It's all there. It's really about shedding the things that we think are us that maybe have caused us to cope or whatever. And it's funny because she was talking about, I don't think I can do that if I don't actually Sabbath. I can't even see what I need to inhabit without actually stopping. And it's like, oh, and then we kind of just sat in that for a second, like, oh, like when we're talking about what does Sabbath actually do? Your dad says, and it's haunted me for years, you can tell him thank you for that. I would like to pass it along to everyone who's listening that I hope it haunts you too. Wow. In a holy way. And I don't know if we said this last on the last podcast, but to, like, you need to, like, stop, leave, receive, yeah, and then rejoice is kind of like when he talks about Sabbath, he talks about that rhythm. And it's like, oh, because you can't receive anything if you don't stop enough to see what you need or what God's trying to, like, invite you to. And then, and I feel like this is totally in the vein of our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then forget about rejoicing, because I don't even know if I know how to rejoice after I receive whatever it is that God has for me. Like, I feel like there's a point where I'm like, okay, wait, how do I rejoice in this? Like, that seems silly. It's not like, oh, joy. There's like, it has to be more than that.
Okay, so Trin. Absolutely. And just in the vein of, you said, stop, leave, receive, rejoice. That's when my dad's talking about that. He's talking Leviticus chapter 23 in the layout of the sacred calendar. In the movement of Shabbat, the first thing listed in the calendar in Leviticus 23, and then leaving Egypt. So stop, then you leave Egypt. So stop, leave, receive, Pentecost, Feast of Weeks, which in Hebrew would be Shavuot. So, you know, first you have Shabbat, stop, then you have leave, Passover or Pesach in Hebrew. Then you have, is what he's saying, receive, you know, Pentecost, Feast of Weeks, and then Shavuot. And then the final one, rejoice, would be Sukkot, Feast Tabernacles or Booths. And there's more stuff listed in there, but that's the kind of movement of stop, leave, receive, rejoice is what you were referencing that he was talking about. So Leviticus chapter 23, Shabbat, Sabbath, Pesach, Passover, leaving, Shavuot, rejoice, or excuse me, stop, leave, receive, excuse me, Shavuot, receive, Feast of Weeks. And then rejoice, Sukkot, Tabernacles or Booths. So, right, that movement of those feasts, those festivals, and just the incredible, the necessity for Shabbat, you know, as you were speaking to. And I love as you were speaking of, it's so hard to inhabit. It can be so hard to inhabit. And what better way to inhabit than to stop, right? You know, it's we talked about it, I think, last time, really helpfully from the perspective of how it's introduced in Genesis chapter 2. But then we were kind of moving to, okay, well, I've lived however many years and I haven't Shabbatted, I haven't Sabbathed, I haven't stopped. So I'm not in Genesis chapter 2, where necessarily the first thing I experience in my life is stopping to be with God in the Garden of Eden. So maybe the first thing I'm in, you know, is it's a very different starting point, right? And in that vein, to me, this is where how helpful to inhabit who God's created us to be eternity in the present tense than by stopping. And I think this is a part of one angle or aspect of what I think that Jesus, what Yeshua is talking about when he says to be in the world, but not of the world, right? In other words, it's, and I think those two can so easily be conflated, but in, but not of it. And to really stop, I think would help me to recognize, okay, where am I being of the world? What are those ways in which I'm taking on and I'm doing things that actually are not of God, but they're really of the world? And it's not to say to not be in community or to not have relationship, but more, where am I actually being of the world?
Yeah, that's good. And I think that's hard. I mean, I feel like we spend a lot of time running from like seeing. That's not an easy question. Where am I of the world?
Yeah.
You're going to have to see some things in your own life that are not necessarily great, where you kind of just yielded to patterns or other ways of inhabiting things that just isn't what would bring you life. And actually probably brings you, I think, the opposite on a daily basis, because it drains you. So it's like, it's just a hard reality. But in the New Testament, it also says like that it's not in condemnation, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think one of the things that's easy to do is condemn myself for having done that. Just as easy to condemn others. How horrible, terrible, evil I am for that thing that I did there. It's like, yeah, okay.
Yep. And I was having this conversation with my Hebrew teacher, because I was telling him with this shift in online church, I have to like preach to my own face on camera every week.
So hard.
It's so hard. I was like, this is so awkward. And he asked me a question that stopped me dead in my tracks. And I was like, ugh. But I was like, I hate this. So I'm like coming up with all these ideas of how I'm going to use a different camera where I can't see my face and maybe it'll be less awkward. And I really love being around people. And I realize how much I feel other people's energy, and I feel, I love that, and the Spirit of God in the room with us all as we're discussing scripture. I'm not really a lecture type pastor. So I'm like, and he asked me this question. He's like, well, it's so easy sometimes for us to see God in other people, you know, that image of God, or that we're all image bearers of God, and see that God in other people. He goes, but is your problem really that when you're looking at your own face, you can't see it in yourself? And I was like, and that was a moment where like, I felt like I was at a moment where I could decide. I could decide what narrative I was going to step into. I felt like I was at the tree in the Garden of Eden. Like, I have a choice. I had a choice to like build up my walls, make excuses, and set up a whole different narrative for myself to actually not take that question in and actually wrestle with, oh, wait, do I have a hard time believing that God is in me? And then what does that say about what I believe about myself, right? I was sitting there and I was like, no, I'm going to ask the hard question. I'm going to wrestle with what it is, like what it really means. And I was like, you're right. I sat there in it for a while and I was like, I think it's because I have a hard time seeing God in my own face. And like, how do you, and then he's like, this is the opportunity because you usually don't get to see your face that much. Like, other than when you get up in the morning, you put your makeup on, which I don't, but you know, I brush my teeth and I pull my hair back. Yeah, I revolt against cosmetics, but whatever. And I'm like, oh, you're right. He goes, like, but people see your face all the time and they see God in you. It's not always outward facing. I think it's a way to get out. And I especially think pastors easily do this, or leaders or teachers like yourself, it can easily become about everybody else. And then we forget that this is for us too. Like, it's just easy because you do care about people. You do care about what they're doing, and what God's like, yeah, but I care about you too. I care about you seeing yourself this way, which ultimately feeds back into your leadership.
So exactly. Like, and
so good.
That is so, and I think it's one of the real tensions, right, with all the technological things that you're speaking of is, you know, on one hand, it can become easy to only ever look at oneself, which is of course not what you're saying at all, right? But using the opportunity to go, oh, there's something in me that I'm seeing that's not what I want to be seeing. And what do I need to change? Maybe not just about my appearance, but about how I'm experiencing something. And I need to actually think about that, which is, I think, you know, hopefully one of the more fruitful things, right? In that vein of, it's not to say, well, I always have to be looking, ooh, I didn't like what my eyes did there. That wasn't what I was looking for. I don't like how my nose scrunches up like that. Oh, that's a bad angle. That's not good for my chin. You know, it's like, no. Like, no, that's not the point, right, at all. It's like, oh, no, there's something I'm seeing in here that's problematic. And I need to actually have a conversation about what it is that's going on here, that's the struggle. And that's what I hear you speaking to, which is, I think, taking such a tremendous, you know, what an opportunity that you're seizing, that God's laying right before you to say, hey, do you see this? This is here. Maybe look at this, right?
I feel like Sabbath provided that opportunity, because I feel like you can do it weekly, but then it goes into like daily, and then it goes into like moments where it's like in that moment, you can stop and see things from a different perspective. And it's almost like it is entering, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like I'm entering Sabbath space to see what's really going on.
When that's when you made the comment about transformation, to me, that just feels, that was so well said. I think that one of the huge, what happens in Shabbat transformation? What happens in transformation? Depends, right? Like what it is. Let's talk about what the situation is, right? And I think in that vein of how it can be happening all the time, in Leviticus 23, I think one of the things that gets laid out so helpfully is we're talking about Shabbat in that context of Leviticus 23. So you have Shabbat. And then after the second Shabbat, it's the 15th evening, you have Passover, Pesach. We're talking about leaving Egypt. And then the next feast that we're talking about is Shavuot, receiving, Pentecost. But it's also literally in Leviticus 23, where it lays out the calendar, referred to as the Feast of Weeks. And it says, you know, count off 7 weeks times seven. So again, we're dealing with seven, you know, this whole Shabbat conversation. So now we're having like a Shabbat of weeks. And then when we get to the seventh month, we have several different different celebrations, things being pointed to, Yom Teruah, Feast of Trumpets, where we have Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, that conversation. But then we have Pentecost. We have Sukkot, Tabernacles, Booths, Rejoicing. But it's all in the seventh month. So now we have like this month that's Sabbath. But then if you move beyond Leviticus 23, we have a sabbatical year. So this idea that like Shabbat is beholden to one day of the week, or can only happen at this time, we see that Shabbat, these sevens, these Shabbats are being, these stoppings are being kind of, it's starting as like a day. Okay, now we have these week conversations. Now we have these month conversations. Now we have these years conversations, and how it can just flow into all different times of the week, right? Because it's not as if you have Shabbat one day, you stop for one day, and then you go to your weekend, you don't even think about that day ever again, or that transformation stays for that one day, and I'm just the same person I always ever was. Don't worry about it. No, not going to change anything else. That's too hard. No, that's not the point. Yeah. Well said.
On this, like, because we've been talking about like stop, leave, receive, rejoice. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's something in like when we stop, what do we have to leave?
Okay, so yes, Jared. So this is what we pointed to, I believe, in the first podcast on Shabbat, which is Egypt. So Egypt, the Hebrew word for Egypt, pretty much every time you look at Egypt throughout scripture, in Hebrew, it's the word Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim has a root. Hebrew's root-based structure of language kicking in here. Most words in Hebrew having a three-letter root. Some have more letters, some have fewer letters. And this word Mitzrayim, which is every time you see it, it'll be translated as Egypt, has a root though. And the root of the word Mitzrayim in Hebrew is the word tsar. Tsar. And so when looking at so many words in Hebrew, when you get down to the root of the word, you really get the core concept that underlies an idea. And then the language builds upon itself. So Mitzrayim, Egypt, has this root tsar, kind of the core underlying idea. And tsar literally means narrow. Narrow. And therefore, Egypt is understood to be the narrow place. Now, for a moment here to think about Egypt, from kind of a topographical perspective, Egypt is very narrow because people are trying to live as close to, if not right on the Nile River. So literally you're all trying to be along the Nile River. So in that sense, very narrow, not necessarily going too broadly out from the Nile River. Would want to suggest it's also spiritually a narrow place because people are forced to worship Pharaoh and the false gods of Egypt. So literally on a physical level, narrow, living along the Nile River, but also spiritually narrow, forced to worship Pharaoh and the false gods of Egypt. And this is kind of a massive conversation. You know, when you talk about what are we leaving, I'm stopping and then I need to leave. After I have two Shabbats in Leviticus 23, I've had two stoppings. Now I'm being told I'm supposed to leave. And the thing I think we're being asked to leave is the narrow place. Well, the text makes it very clear. We are being asked to leave the narrow place. And then I think really the question becomes, what is the narrow place I'm being asked, invited to leave?
Well, and I think Egypt is... when we look at narrow places in our own lives, like, I feel like the text is also like, Egypt is physically narrow, but it's also spiritually narrow. Because mm-hmm. when you live there, you worship Pharaoh and the false gods of Egypt, right? And the whole point of Moses, like, drawing the people out is, like, leave so they can go from worshiping you, Pharaoh, to worshiping Yahweh. So, like, so there's this whole like connection of like, it's spiritual too. And mm-hmm. I feel like in life, things are physical and also spiritual. Like there's two sides of the same coin. Like, so like, I feel like there's places we can leave in real life that are physical places, like jobs that are just super narrow or relationships, but there's also like a spiritual element to that as well. As what's happening to us that is connected to the physical. So like, and they can also just be spiritual spaces as well. So like, there's just kind of like a multi-dimensional kind of thing going on here. And like, so when we talk about like, what is my narrow place? You know, my narrow place that I was just talking about was I need to see God in my own face. Mm-hmm. Like my narrow place is there is some identity things that I need to just inhabit that God created me the way that I am. And there is God in me. And that is beautiful. It's not just in other people. And I need to stop like letting people tell me who I am, tell me who, and even negatively tell me who I am. and outside, like, no, that's not what I, but we inhabit those things. Like sometimes those things can shape us. And so it's like, oh, so this question is really about, do I know who I am? And I mean, I know this is probably really controversial, a pastor talking about, oh my gosh, she's having identity struggles. But like, can we just get real for a second? Isn't that most of life for most people? That they're discovering more of actually who they are and more of who they're not. And we all struggle with identity. Like, when we're doing something or we feel called to do something, the first ticker tape voice in our head is, are you actually good enough to do that? Are you actually able to do that? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all have that. So like, you know, let's just be honest.
Absolutely. And these narrow places, as you said, can be so many different things, right? There's a phrase that's been said at the Passover Seder meal. It's in most of the kind of the Seder orders for the evening, the Haggadah in Hebrew. And at the Passover meal, there's a phrase that's said. It's been said, like I said, thousands of years. And the phrase goes something like, "This year we are slaves in Egypt. Next year may we be free in Jerusalem." And to this day, those words are said when people are doing their Passover meals. And they say, they've been saying this for thousands of years, regardless of where they live in the world. They say these words, "This year we are slaves in Egypt, next year may we be free in Jerusalem." And clearly, as you pointed to, we're not just talking about, oh, if I'm not living in Egypt, those words no longer apply to me. It's like, absolutely not, no. This year, I am a slave to something in a narrow place. Next year, may I be free in Jerusalem, city of peace, city of wholeness, however one wants to translate that, right? So, and that dynamic of, I am in a narrow place in some aspect quality of my life. And part of what Passover, part of what Pesach is talking about is the leaving of the narrow place. I mean, Dad likes to say Passover, it's really an incredible oversimplification. You can kind of get Passover down to two words, and there's so many more puzzle pieces to Passover. Part of the core essence of it is Passover down to two words, leave Egypt, right? Leave Egypt, leave the narrow place. What are the narrow places? And as you said, it could be a job for someone. It could be a relationship. It could be how I relate to this thing that I'm reading online all the time. It could be how I treat my friends. It could be how I watch sports. For me, that was definitely one for several years. It could be how I feel about money. It could be, you know, where am I finding my self-worth? It could be so many things that those are all Egypts, or could be Egypts. And there, that's where, you know, to make this strictly like a, oh, you have to leave Egypt. You stop, you leave Egypt. Well, you leave the narrow place. Well, what are the narrow places? And those can change year over year. Let's say 1 year that a narrow place, I really need to leave. We're at Passover. I'm saying this phrase, or whatever time of year it is, right? I'm saying I need to leave the narrow place. Narrow place for me is how much time I spend on my phone. You know, I have that, whatever that app on my phone that says I spend 2.5 hours a day on my phone, and I need to spend less time on my phone. So I'm going to, narrow place, I need to leave, spend less time on my phone. Great. Okay. So let's say I spend less time on my phone, and maybe it's 6 months later, a year later, and I go, you know, I'm playing video games about 3 hours a day. And all that time I was on my phone, but I'm not on my phone, I'm just playing video games. I think I have another narrow place I need to leave. Okay, so let's say I leave playing video games, and maybe it's weeks or months later, and I kind of go, you know, now that I really have more time to think, I'm not really comfortable with how I'm always trying to make this amount of money. And so I really need to have a different attitude towards that, because it's kind of clouding how much fun that I'm in, how much I'm experiencing life with the people that I'm with, because I'm always concerned about how much money I have or don't have. And so what these narrow places are might change all the time. And some of them might circle around again. You know, maybe I leave that narrow place of how much I'm on my phone, and, you know, 5 years later, oh, I'm doing it again, and I have downloaded all these apps and games on my phone, and I need to leave that once more. So what are these narrow places? And they might be recurring. They might be ones that are really difficult to leave. And just one more little fast thing on this, which is, when I talk about relationships or maybe another person, I don't necessarily want to make that it's, oh, I have this friend, his name is Bob, and Bob is a narrow place for me. But it actually might not be that Bob is a problem at all. It might be that how I'm relating to Bob is quite an issue. That when I'm with Bob, I behave like I was when I was 17, which wasn't all that great a lot of the time. And that for some reason, when I'm with Bob, that's what comes out of me. But it's actually not Bob's fault. It's how I'm relating to Bob. And so that's a narrow place. And so I need to be different in how I'm in that relationship. Or maybe Bob tests my patience, but it's actually an opportunity for me to really grow more patient, which is going to be helpful someday, probably when I have kids, you know, like you're out of the one, right? So just that dynamic, that quality, that aspect of a narrow place and what constitutes a narrow place. I don't just want to make it like, it's a narrow place, therefore it's objectively narrow place for everyone or for everything. And it might be it's actually how I'm relating to something, how I'm connecting to that. And it's far more a reflection on, oh, I need to change something here. I need to leave this because this isn't working. And we gotta switch this up.
And I always think, like, because when we talk about the narrow place, like, you can leave something. And honestly, like, the people left Egypt and they only knew how to be slaves. Mm-hmm. And when they got into the wilderness, they actually had to unlearn. Like, they physically left the place of Egypt and slavery and worshiping, having to worship the idols and whatever. And they get into the wilderness and they have to, like, leave spiritually Egypt and the way they've always lived. And it's, yes. So it's not always like cut and dry. You're not always like, I cut the rug and I'm free. And it's like 2 seconds long. Like, the people left the physical place, but it took how many years in the wilderness to relearn, like, or to learn, because they never knew how to be free. So they're like, I'm going to leave slavery from worshiping, you know, Pharaoh and the false gods of Egypt, but I don't even know how to actually serve Yahweh. So, like, there's this whole, like, so the leaving process can be exactly that, like, a process of, like, how do I learn to do and be something that maybe I've never actually inhabited before? And it can be a process, because one of the first things they do is complain.
Yes.
They come across the bitter water, right? And they're like, what? This isn't the water we know, like the Nile. And it's bitter, but, you know, it's water that doesn't have the blood of your people in it. Like, yeah. It's like
details, right?
Details. So then they're like, then they cross over there. And then they come to, like, they eventually come to God's mountain. And the first thing they do when Moses goes up and it looks like a consuming fire is build an idol. Like, we think it's crazy, but it's what they've always done. Of course it makes sense. They don't know what to do, so they kind of go back to what they've always done. So, like, I say all this to say that leaving is, it looks different in some ways, and sometimes it takes longer than, you know, you may physically leave a place, but then you have to deal with maybe some trauma that has happened in that place. And, you know, it takes time.
I think that is so well said. The leaving of the narrow place, I think, looks so easy and simple. Who wouldn't want to be free? It is so not that simple. As you said, it's 3 days in Exodus 15. And it actually, you know, the whole bitter waters of Marah passage, right? But it also refers to the people as being bitter. The people are bitter. It's a whole study, right? Exodus 15, the people are bitter. Oh, here's water. We're bitter. This isn't the water, and this is we're in the wilderness. You know, we come to Mount Sinai, as you said, Moses goes up, the people see consuming fire. It says he goes up in a cloud, Exodus 24. Okay, right? And within months, this is just a few months in, we'll build the golden calf. And it's like, wait, and we're all thinking, how could they do that? How dare they do that? You know, but then we have things with, we see to this very day, alcoholism. You know, which goes generationally, because I think we sometimes forget they were slaves in the narrow place in Egypt for 400 years, right? 400 years of a kind of institutionalized, ingrained, embedded slavery that, as you said, isn't just physical. There are so many things that get into the DNA of all I know is a slave. For the vast majority of us, do we really remember Joseph? Some probably, it seems clearly, they do. For others, all we know is slavery. All our ancestors were slaves. All we get is slavery. This is the only thing. As far as I wake up, I go to sleep, I'm a slave. My whole life will be as a slave. I'll live for as long as I can as a slave, and I build stuff for Pharaoh, and I'm living in Egypt, and I'm a slave. And I think we sometimes miss how hard it is to actually leave those narrow places. And it might even seem so simple, the long time that it might take and the process that it is. Just as you were speaking to, let's say a narrow place for a person nowadays is, I threw out one was how money. Money is a narrow place for me. And so I just think I have these issues with money, and it's not spending money, but it's I'm kind of too tight with money, and it's unhealthy how much I think about needing to have more money, right? And I think it's just me. But then let's say actually, if I really look back historically, you know, my grandparents in the Great Depression, they had some real issues not having money. And so there was, and there's things that are just literally embedded in the bones of who we are, in the very fabric of who we are on just a literal level that, oh, there's trauma that's from that. But then it's what it means to come to America as an immigrant. Oh, okay, so then I had to give up everything. I how many generations back people come over here with nothing. And that's all in there when one relates to money. But then you were coming from impoverished Eastern Europe that, you know, you were barely able to survive, and how many people were being killed and murdered, and there just wasn't even enough food. And then you're realizing, oh, this whole conversation about money is actually the part of the reason I'm having difficulty with this is there's whole, I don't know even how many generations of people that when it came to resources, basic resources that would help them to survive, this was never a guarantee. This was not a surety. And so now I'm having these issues and I'm relating to it, but actually this goes back hundreds of years. And then why can't I do this better? Why is it taking me so long? Why am I having so much trouble? It's not that simple. It's really not that simple. There is so much history, there's so much past. And I think we particularly live in a context that says, you know, the past is the past. You have to leave history in history, and it has no bearing on today. You know how people will say that nowadays. And it's such a silly, absurd, self-centered and egotistical way of thinking, to put it. You know, this idea that like I am a whole, you know, world unto myself, and I have nothing that happened before me has any bearing on who I am today. No, there's all of these things that we aren't even conscious of. We're so unaware, I think, particularly in America, you know, living in a world that, in a country specifically, I should say, that you know, people just don't always know their history and how important that history is to getting, oh, when I'm having a hard time leaving this job, maybe it's because work wasn't always a given. And maybe it's because, or I had this relationship with authority figures, because part of why this job isn't a real place for me is my boss, and it's just not a good environment. But actually, that's how my dad related to his boss, and his mom related to her boss. And you know, it's like, oh, this is actually way more complicated than I realized. And it's not just simply me, you know, skipping through a meadow saying I'm going to quit my job. It's like,
and on this whole like identity thing, like this year, I've been realizing like God has been bringing this up. And part of my identity, I'm a multiracial woman. My grandmother's a war bride from the Philippines and was actually a child bride with an arranged marriage. 13 years old to a 40-year-old after World War II. And I uncovered this residual, doing the self-work, residual pain from my family. We don't know. Because her family was in the middle of World War II and they literally slaughtered so many people in the Philippines. Like, we don't know who survived, who didn't. And my family tree literally stops. And so like, I had to confront the fact in my own self that like, I am not just, my history doesn't matter. Like there is generational trauma there that I had to even dig up myself. And I remember being with a friend praying and talking about it. And she literally told me, right now, I feel like I hear the cries of your grandmother through you. And I was just like, I stopped and I was like, there was just this realization that like, some people have the ability to disconnect from their history because they just don't know. They aren't aware of how their history, like you were just outlining how to go back and how complicated it can be, because they just don't see it. Versus I feel like certain groups of people are viscerally aware because they have to live with generational trauma a little bit more out in the front. And they're even discovering more and more of it. And so like, yeah, like you can't disconnect from your history. Like there are people that, I mean, like things in their family have carried down because they survived the Great Depression. They survived Vietnam wars, and like their family had a hard time. And so like this became a family value, because money became a family value because you didn't have it. I mean, for so long. And now you had to be responsible and care for your family in a time of crisis. So it's like, and for me, it's like, literally, I had to come to grips with the fact that my family and my lineage comes out of a place of war and a lot of blood and violence. And so, like, and to the point where they, like, burned even the records of the people because they wanted to wipe them off the, like, they never existed. They didn't just kill people. They literally burned records of them ever existing. And so it's really hard to find people that may have survived in my family in the Philippines because they wanted to wipe it, like, wipe them out. And so there's just, like, you can't separate. Like, it's not that easy. And when you go back and you dig far enough and you're willing to ask these really courageous questions, you find out exactly, like, where the roots of where we sometimes act or cope or are, where they lie. And it takes courage and a lot of bravery to do that. And Shabbat is how you do it. Cause, like, literally the first thing God teaches these people in the wilderness is Shabbat. This is what you do. This is how you stop, because you can't even receive how to worship God if you don't just baseline. Like, you need to stop.
The phrase that your friend said, she said, "When I'm hearing you, I'm hearing the cries of your grandmother." Is that what she said? Yes. That is just stunning. I was going to say, one of the things I think about, because we've talked about a little bit about this before, and one of the things I think about when I see you doing what you're doing today, I also feel like you are the answer to your grandmother's prayers. Mm. Right? Like, you are the fulfillment of what your grandmother prayed.
You know what's crazy? I never told you this, Noah.
Yeah.
And you're saying this right now? Okay, my grandma is a 4'8" Filipino lady who is very feisty. And, you know, she'll tell you that she'll karate you. That's not even a correct sentence. I didn't even know this until probably about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, she took me into her room and she told me, "It is my job to pray for you. It's my job to help you in prayer become all that you need to." Because she was so proud of becoming a pastor, which is weird because, like, she was like rebel, woo, you know. But she was like, and she took me to her dresser and she has these, like, I always get her these, like, little candles because she likes to light them and pray. What I didn't notice before is she has names written on them. And on there, she showed me, "This one's yours." Now, guys, she had 10 kids. Two didn't survive. I have a lot of cousins. She's got a lot of grandbabies. Like, and on her little dresser is a candle for me. And there are not candles for everyone there. Or I swear she would have no room. And I looked at her and I was like, "Grandma, why me?" Well, I was the one that she took care of when my parents split up when I was young. We had a different kind of relationship. And she's like, she kind of said this, like, "Because it's you." And I'm like, I didn't understand that at the time. And this was like 13 years ago, 12, 13 years ago, until you're saying now, like, this is like flashing in my head of like, oh my God, my grandma has prayed for me. I don't even know how many decades, lighting this candle every night, even through her dementia. What?
Eternity in the present tense. Yes. Right. This is the very thing we started with. You know, it's eternity in the present tense. Oh, here it is. You know, here's the prayers of your grandmother. Present tense. That is such a beautiful story because I think those moments happen to us more often than we realize. A woman said in a study, this last year, she made the comment, "What does it mean to think that I might be the answer to someone's prayer from 500 years ago?" And, you know, it's just like, what does it mean to actually think that way, to experience eternity in the present tense? Of, you know, I think we're always thinking of, because there is all the trauma piece, And there's all of the everything else too in the whole spectrum of our life experience, right? And to really stop, to enter into God time, eternity, in the present tense, and just what's possible in that space is, yeah.
It is unbelievable. I've never made that connection, Noah, till like right now. Like, I'm just thinking, how cool is that? Like, and now I don't think I'll be able to just go forward with like, no big deal. Now it's like going to be in my head. I'm the answer to my grandmother's prayers.
And think about all of your grandmothers, you know, and here you are, you know, and so, you know, when I think sometimes we think so little of ourselves or so nothing of ourselves, it's not to say that by any means we're the center of everything, but just this idea that I'm irrelevant or I don't matter. What people have been doing for so, so long, you know, we are one, yeah, as we talked about Tov, you know, here we are, one seed in a massive orchard, you know, one drop of water in a gargantuan river. And
it's always generational, like communal, like this really puts it into perspective of like, I'm the Tov of my grandmother's Tov.
Yeah, like, yes.
Right? And it's just crazy.
And those adorably cute kids that we were hearing a few moments ago, right? Here's your Tov.
And they always, exactly. They call my grandma great grandma. You know, are we gonna go see great grandma? And they're so excited, even though like great grandma doesn't remember them every time. Mm-hmm. But there's something weird because like she doesn't remember them, and I've been introducing them for 7 years. But who she always remembers when I walk through the door is me. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make sense to me.
Like, there it is.
I'm like, why do you still remember? But she grabs me and whispers in my ear and calls me by name. And I'm like, this is nuts. And so like, yeah, there's just something there that a lot of times I feel like I'm reclaiming myself, but also it's linked to my mother and my grandmother, and it's linked to my family as I inhabit who I am and the full story of who I am. I'm also doing that for my family, and I'm doing that for my grandmother, who had a really tough life, and I'm doing that for my kids. And to think that like there was Shabbat space that my grandma was practicing for decades. Yeah. It's not even just our Shabbat space. Like this makes me think of how is my practicing Shabbat and stepping into eternity going to affect other people? Mm-hmm. Because we're not so insular and like siloed and so individual. Like it's so wildly connected to not step into it is to also deny those coming after you of what will come out of that space. Because it's not just about us. And I don't know if I'm good with that. Like, I don't know if I can put off Shabbat or stepping into that because now it's not just about me.
The familial communal implications are so vast. I mean, to your point, right? It's this idea of, you know, and we touched on something a little bit last time, but just as you were saying it here, you know, I'm stopping and people might think I'm being lazy or I'm being unproductive or because I'm Shabbating, I'm stopping. So, you know, it's not just for me. The implications that this has for one's children, for one's family, for one's community, for, you know, the ripples keep going. You know, I think of like a rock, in a pond, just how it goes so far out. If one can actually see how far those ripples go. It goes so, so far. The notion that it's just like, plump, massive rock in the water and there's a little like, drop, and then it's just nothing. It's like, no, you missed the ripple. I'm missing the ripple in what I do that. I'm actually not seeing And who knows what that looks like? And I think part of what gets to be so deliciously complex is when one experiences eternity in the present tense, as you were just speaking of, which is so beautiful to hear, kind of watch you as great that's happening. Okay, so I'm experiencing eternity in the present tense, and I have no idea what the implications are of this long term. Like, you know, and like maybe I get some seeings of it, but I might not have any idea how this actually, what this looks like, how this works, how this manifests. And maybe I'm not, I don't need to know that, and that that's okay.
Yeah, it's, oh, the Bible's so cool. God is so right. Cool. God is so cool. I mean, it's just so, so deep. And I feel like that's really the heart of what you and I want to do, is just dive into that and help other people dive into just, it's just so beautiful. Like, it's like the key to living a life of abundance, I think. It's not really about money or things. It's just like when you can really inhabit life, it changes the very like fabric of time and how you experience it and other people, changes the level of relationship you can have when you step into something like this. Is just
transformative, you know, as you said.
It is. It's transformative. You inhabit your actual self, and in this crazy way, you find family that you never knew that were part of your story. And it's just, God does so much stuff. And yeah, it truly, truly is. Like, when I think of Yeshua saying, like, I haven't come to get rid of the law, or, you know, abolish the law, but to fulfill it, and so that you can have life and life to the full. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like Yeshua's trying to live out the Torah. He's not preaching something that already hasn't been given to the people. Like, he's literally coming and he's quoting scripture. He's quoting Torah. He's quoting scripture, the prophetic books, from Psalms, from Deuteronomy. Like, he knows the stories and he's bringing them to the people. And that's why I think it's so crucial that we're having this conversation, because Jesus, like, that's what he did. We need to know the stories. He thinks it's important for us Christians, then it should be important. And think of all the beautiful conversations that have happened with you in our church, and us just gathering and just loving on each other, and God works and beauty just fills the place. It's just important gathering, truly seeing each person and seeing the God in them, and practicing Shabbat.
Amen.
We will continue. I think we're going to turn the conversation next time to something different, a little different. Mm-hmm. So I will leave that hanging so everyone can get excited about that. We're going to jump into something new. Thank you, everybody, for joining this conversation. I'm super excited that we are just going to continue to dive in together, Noah and I and everyone who's listening. And I'm just super excited to just continue this journey and see where it brings us and the beauty that comes forth from stepping into these conversations together. So thank you, Noah. We'll see you next time. Thank you.